Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Kate Dinner. I represent the plaintiff appellants, Stacey Alexander and Kim Rogers, in this race discrimination claim. As discussed in the brief, the plaintiffs believe that the district court made several errors in granting summary judgment in favor of the Casino Queen and against them. I want to particularly discuss two of those errors this morning. The first has to do with whether disparate treatment of Ms. Alexander and Ms. Rogers compared to their white coworkers, which resulted in the loss of tip income or the potential to earn greater tip income, could constitute adverse actions. There were a number of incidents of disparate treatment, including Ms. Rogers not being able to work 2 weeks when she'd submitted her resignation, where her white coworkers had. The removal of some lucrative areas of the casino floor from Ms. Alexander's assigned territory, and particularly the routine displacement of Ms. Rogers and Ms. Alexander when ad hoc reassignments of the areas of the casino floor were made to cover for absent waitresses.
Could you just clear up something for me real quick? So, on this reassignment issue, was the waitress relieved of her own area and given a new area, or was the new area added on to the area she already had?
As Ms. Alexander and Ms. Rogers testified, in many cases what happened was they had a good area because they were high in seniority and bid that area, but when the ad hoc reassignments were made, they were removed from that area and sent over to an area such as the penny slots.
Okay, but the reassignment was made because somebody didn't show up. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Well, why wasn't that person who didn't show up just assigned to the penny slot area then?
Well, they had to expand. Instead of, say, five waitresses, there would be four waitresses
right
there. So everybody had to cover more territory than they would ordinarily have done. Logically, you would think that they would just expand two of the waitresses' areas in each direction to cover for the part that wouldn't be where the absent waitress was. But that isn't what happened.
So they completely lost their old area. Is that
in many instances, they did. Yes, they estimated several times a week over a course of 2.5 years.
Thank you.
Ms. Denner, if I could follow up along those lines, I understood the district judge to be saying that the differences in tips could well be important enough for these to amount to adverse actions. I'm looking at page 14 of his opinion on summary judgment. But he goes on to say that, in essence, plaintiffs just didn't come forward with enough evidence on this subject. I'd be interested to hear your response on that point, because, frankly, it does seem to me if you've got significant differences in tips, tips are a big part of compensation, a huge part of compensation here.
A huge part in their case, over 50% of what they took home on most days.
But what did you give the district judge to work with?
They both testified. They could not, of course, say exactly what they would have earned in tips if they had not been displaced on any given day. They both gave a range of tips that they made on a typical day. In Ms. Alexander's case, I believe it was $75 to $150 per day that she made in tips.
Depending on which area she was in?
Well, and then she also testified, and this was not pointed out to the district judge in all fairness, because the casino didn't argue it in their motion for summary judgment, so it didn't become an issue until the district court ruled in that respect. But on pages 222 and 437 of the Record on Appeal, there are excerpts from both of their depositions in which they estimated that they lost approximately $50 a day on average when they were displaced from their area to another area of the casino floor. So that is in the record.
Okay. Give me a little better hint, if you can, on where the Record on Appeal, the different people use different numberings. What are those two sources?
Oh, those are Ms. Rogers and Ms. Alexander's deposition testimony that was attached as exhibits to the casino's motion for summary judgment.
Did they put the entire transcripts in?
They did.
Okay.
But it was just an estimate, wasn't there? I mean, they just kind of guessed what they were
doing. Well, it was an educated guess or an educated estimate. They knew from their experience of working different areas of the floor, and the reassignment was not the same every time. So it would be impossible for them to say with precision on any given day, here's what I would have made in another in the other area versus here's what I made. But if we can imagine a situation in which a waitress moves back and forth between working at a high-end steakhouse and a coffee shop, she might not know what she would have made on a given day if she'd worked at the steakhouse instead of the coffee shop, but she knows on average that she makes a lot more at the steakhouse, and she's competent to give an estimate of how much more that would be.
Would you agree that there has to be some minimal amount of loss to constitute or support a conclusion that there's an adverse employment action?
Yes, I would agree with that.
And so we're going to have to struggle with where that is, right?
I do believe that there's a line somewhere, and if it was a one-day occurrence or a small amount of tips or any other circumstances in which the court would judge, you know, it's such a low amount of money that it really doesn't matter. But what they're talking about is an average of $50 per day several times a week for a 2.5-year period. And I would say wherever the line is drawn, they're definitely on the side of the line that would constitute an adverse employment action.
Ms. Denner, could I ask you another factual matter here? You've been talking about the adjustments, the ad hoc adjustments made when somebody was absent, right? On regular days, when everybody showed up for your clients, is there any evidence that was brought to the district court's attention that they were given assignments that were contrary to the procedures used under the collective bargaining agreement on the bidding on seniority for those different areas?
No. Their concern was when
just
there
the
were ad hoc,
ad hoc
reassignments
okay.
made. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, so I think we agree that there are some circumstances in which the loss of tips might result in an adverse employment action. And in this case, then the Casino Queen didn't give any legitimate non-discriminatory reason for why it took the actions that resulted in Ms. Rogers and Ms. Alexander losing out on tips or losing out on the opportunity to make greater tips. They didn't give any reason for removing the dollar slot area, which was a good area for tips, from Ms. Alexander's bidded area after she had been awarded it. They didn't give any reason for not letting Ms. Rogers work out the rest of her 2 weeks after she gave her notice, as she observed white waitresses being allowed to do. They didn't give any reason for routinely displacing Ms. Rogers and Ms. Alexander from their good tipping areas when they made the ad hoc reassignments. And because the casino did not come forward with any legitimate non-discriminatory reason for those actions, Ms. Rogers and Ms. Alexander should have survived summary judgment under the indirect method of proof, the McDonnell-Douglas method, and therefore the case should be reversed and remanded for trial.
Didn't Ms. Carey say something about the reasons for these ad hoc adjustments? I mean, she had her contingent floor plans that she testified about in her affidavit.
She did, and actually at page 476 in the Record on Appeal, which is our brief in response to the motion for summary judgment, it's explained why Ms. Carey's testimony is not credible. She puts forth a document that she claims was signed by the cocktail waitresses in 2008 in which they approved those contingent floor plans. If the document on which the waitresses' signatures appears is compared to a roster of waitresses that the casino also produced and that's also in the record, it couldn't possibly have been signed in 2008. In fact, it couldn't possibly have been signed until sometime in 2010 based on the names that are on the sign-up sheet compared to when different waitresses were hired and left their employment. Ms. Rogers and Ms. Alexander also testified that they had never seen those contingent floor plans. Nobody had ever shown them those contingent floor plans, even though they lodged complaints about how the ad hoc reassignments were being made, and on summary judgment, their testimony that there was no such thing as the contingent floor plans has to be credited. Now, Ms. Rogers and Ms. Alexander believe that they have enough evidence that this case should go back for trial, but if, in fact, the court disagrees, they believe that it should still be remanded to the district court with instructions to reconsider the motion for summary judgment and take into consideration the evidence from the Riley Jackson lawsuit that they proffered to the court and that the court summarily decided not to consider.
Right. Well, why didn't the plaintiffs join the Riley Jackson lawsuit?
Pardon me?
Why didn't the plaintiffs join the Riley Jackson lawsuit?
Well, it's interesting. You talked about a fluke of timing in the previous case. It was a fluke of timing. They had a different attorney. They brought a prior lawsuit. Because of their attorney's misconduct, that lawsuit was dismissed. By that time, the Riley Jackson lawsuit was going. And so they brought their second lawsuit for the time
couldn't
after.
Couldn't they have joined?
I really don't know that. That would probably be an issue between them and the attorneys who are bringing the Riley Jackson lawsuit. I don't know of any judicial or legal reason why they couldn't have.
On this issue, I understand your point that a deposition from another case is not really any different from an affidavit that a party finds on his or her own, but I don't understand why the Riley Jackson materials were not filed in this case to make them part of this record so that the district judge would know this is evidence that is in this case. And we on review could say this is part of the evidence.
It's somewhat difficult to, I think, to determine what filed means in the era of PACER. It would
means there's a docket entry with attachments in this docket number, as opposed to saying, Judge, scour the files in your entire division or district.
Well, respectfully, I don't think I was asking the district court judge to scour the files. We gave specific sites to the case number, the document number, the page and line number, which were accessible through PACER.
Would that work if the case were pending in a different district?
I believe that it would if, in fact, those documents had been identified in discovery as potentially, I've got a yellow light on, as potentially relevant documents, if the witnesses whose testimony was given in those documents were identified as potential witnesses in the case, and if the testimony met all the other criteria, that it was based on personal knowledge, that it was relevant, that it wasn't hearsay, and so forth, then I believe that the court could take judicial notice of documents that had been filed in another case that were available through PACER.
Any precedent? Any other court that has accepted that as a method for submitting evidence? Like this?
Because of the newness of these procedures of having things available on PACER, I've not located any, but I haven't located any to the contrary either.
Didn't Justice or Judge Steele say that they weren't the same parties, so that the the rule didn't apply?
My red light is on, Your
Honor. That's all right.
The defendant was the same. The plaintiffs were different. But it really doesn't matter when you're talking about a motion for summary judgment whether the parties were the same or not. It's still sworn testimony recorded in written form, and if it's relevant to the matter at hand, it should be treated the same as an affidavit would be treated.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stenner. Mr. Horner?
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Garrett Horner. I'm here on behalf of Defendant Appellee Casino Queen Incorporated. I'd like to begin this morning addressing the procedural issue that was just left with this Court. And it's the Casino Queen's position that the District Court properly concluded that the deposition testimony from the Riley Jackson case should not be considered in this case. And for multiple reasons. And, Your Honor, I believe that you mentioned the first that I was going to touch on, is that those deposition transcripts simply are not part of the record in this case, as required by Rule 56 when considering a motion for summary judgment. In particular, Rule 56C1 that addresses supporting factual positions in Part A provides very plainly that a party asserting that a fact cannot be or is genuinely disputed must be supported by A, citing to particular parts of material in the record. These deposition transcripts are obviously not part of the record. Plaintiffs have acknowledged as much because they've sought to supplement the record in the district court. That was denied. They sought to supplement the record with this court, and this court properly denied it because they were never filed in this case. I respectfully disagree with counsel's position that electronic filing somehow changes how the courts are to look at the records on appeal. You still have to make a record within your particular case rather than citing matters somewhere else within that district court clerk or otherwise. And that's simply not the case here. So it's not part of the record. Under Rule 56, it's not properly considered. In particular, Rule 56C3 talks about obviously the court is to consider the record. It can consider the material cited in the record or other matters that not. It may consider other matters not cited in the record, but of course anything considered needs to be in the record. Secondly, the court also touched on this grounds, in addition to the fact that it wasn't filed, that these transcripts are not admissible under Rule 32A because the testimony does not involve the same subject matter between the same parties.
Well, they may or may not be usable against you at trial in this case, but how is it any different from an affidavit at summary judgment?
Well, there are other circuits that have considered them to be utilized as affidavits.
Right. Professors Wright and Miller and Professor Moore, those treatises endorse that approach.
There's the Baltus case that we cite that came from
Baltus this circuit. Baltus is entirely different. That was just the lawyer just threw a mess at the district judge, and we said he didn't have to sort it out. But we haven't rejected what the plaintiffs at least were trying to do here.
Well, I would also note, Your Honor, Rule 56C2, Rule 56C1B contemplates the other way by which you can support factual positions, and it contemplates that showing that the material cited do not establish the absence or presence of a genuine dispute or that an adverse party cannot produce admissible evidence to support the fact. So I believe under this rule, as the rules were modified, I believe, in 2010, that it does contemplate admissible evidence to be considered at the summary judgment stage, and I think that's consistent with Baldus.
I don't follow that. Is an affidavit admissible?
An affidavit is
for summary judgment.
It can be considered. You're correct.
It's routine, right?
It is.
Even though it's not admissible at trial, you have to have evidence live. We're dealing with the basics here.
Correct.
Not rocket science. But how is How is it any different to provide a deposition of a witness's testimony rather than an affidavit when if you can subpoena that person for trial, you can get that same evidence in perfectly admissible form?
Well, I believe that I understand that other circuits have considered that to be an affidavit. I just simply rely on the Baltus case, but I certainly do understand what you're saying, and I think that nevertheless, I would go back to the fact that we're talking about transcripts that aren't part of the record at any rate.
You do have that. You caught a break on that one. Your former HR director saying that black waitresses were discriminated against, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the other.
Well, those transcripts, in the other case, they speak for themselves. Obviously, we dispute what was being said in them, but nevertheless, they're not part of the record.
They say what they say.
Case.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, moving to the substantive issues, I think this case is more about the absence of evidence than what the evidence is. And I think it's our position that the district court correctly noted that in several respects. When it comes to the prima facie case, we believe that the district court properly granted summary judgment on plaintiff's discrimination cases under Title VII in 1981 and the retaliation claims because there are no genuine issues of material fact with respect to both the direct and indirect method. In the direct method, there is simply no evidence of anything that comes near to
an admission. Aren't we past indirect and direct method? Perez says that you consider it the situation as a whole, and you don't confine yourself to what this court called an ossified system of following these recipes for direct and indirect method.
Well, I'm speaking as to what was considered by the district court. But as far as the prima facie elements of the claim, we do dispute in particular that there is any sufficient evidence that the loss of tips constitutes an adverse employment action in this case because...
Let me ask you real quickly. Can loss of tips ever be a basis for to support an adverse employment action?
If proven to be regular part of compensation, and if proven to be significant,
right? So
because I believe that is the obviously if it's a component.
How about $50 a day?
Mm-hmm. $50 a day. I don't think that's necessarily significant.
I think that's roughly the minimum wage for 8 hours. It's a little bit below, but
well, I think you have to look at the totality of the circumstances, and that's what we don't have here. You know, what is significant to one person may not be significant to another. And
you don't think $250 a week would be significant to the plaintiffs? The evidence we have is that it's more than half of their compensation. That's not...
No, actually, Your Honor, it's our position, and I think the district court properly found that there is insufficient evidence of what it actually is. There's no comparison as to what tips were received in one area versus another.
What about the evidence that Ms. Denner told us about in the depositions, the estimate of $50 a day difference?
Well, I believe the district court properly found that the estimates and the ranges that were provided by the plaintiffs were speculative at best and not sufficient to
constitute an adverse employment action. How can that be decided on summary judgment? They know what they were earning. They were there. Your folks, your managers, obviously thought this was a pretty significant deal. The assignments are governed by the collective bargaining agreement. Ms. Carey was trying to be careful, according to her, to be fair in the way she allocated this because of these financial consequences, right?
Well, I don't think it's entirely because of the financial consequences of it. I think that bidding is routine in collective bargaining agreements as to selection of positions, and they can be selected for any number of reasons. But with respect to the ad hoc reassignments, I believe that the evidence shows that there was no discriminatory intent. It was only implemented when needed. It was implemented pursuant to a collective bargaining agreement and pursuant to contingent plans.
But couldn't a reasonable jury find that there was a discriminatory intent? I mean, isn't that what we're talking about? We're not making judgment calls here. We're deciding whether some reasonable jury or reasonable judge could, on these facts, decide for the non-movement?
No, based upon the evidence in this record, I don't believe so, because they plaintiffs have acknowledged that they've only been reassigned or moved when somebody doesn't show up and they're shorthanded. It's done. There's evidence that it's pursuant to a contingent plan. There's no evidence whatsoever.
There's also evidence that the contingent plans were a phantom, right? Plaintiffs, Ms. Carey testified that she followed these plans. Plaintiffs said they never saw them, never heard of them, right?
Well, yes, that
was
the testimony.
Right?
Correct.
So for summary judgment,
I believe for summary judgment, there's an absolute lack of evidence that anybody similarly situated that's not in a protected class was treated any differently as well. There's an identity of four individuals, but there were no depositions of those individuals ever taken by the plaintiffs.
She didn't have to take their depositions.
There was no information from personnel files or otherwise. There's absolutely no evidence related to the similarly situated people to whom the plaintiffs compared themselves. So under those circumstances, I think the prima facie case fails on the fourth element as well.
If it was part of the bargaining agreement, why would it be in the agreement if it wasn't for financial reward?
Well, seniority-based decisions in collective bargaining agreements are oftentimes done because the seniority, based on seniority, the people who've been there longer want to have a choice.
Well, the choice isn't it invariably for the hours and the location that produce the greatest revenue?
I would say oftentimes it would be, certainly. But I think there's other factors to be considered, too. Location, maybe volume. You know, there may be an area like the penny slots may be higher volume than the what would be considered high roller slot areas, which may be higher volume than certain table games. You know, it could be that somebody doesn't want to work in a crowded area. It could be that people were moved to, it could be that certain individuals may be moved on an ad hoc basis to a more crowded area because they're a more seasoned, more suitable employee to work in that area. You know, there are a lot of things that could go into
and there's also decision. Concern that a heavily white crowd may prefer white waitresses, right?
No, I've never heard that concern. And as far as the legitimate business reason for these decisions, I think that the affidavit of Kelly Carey articulates that it was done pursuant to a collective bargaining agreement. It was done when they were shorthanded, and it was done pursuant to contingent plans. So I believe that has been.
My question on that is, in Carey's affidavit, these contingent plans weren't governed by the CBA, were they?
I don't know if they were developed with the union, but it would be a mandatory topic of bargaining. So if the union wanted to address it with them, they're free to do so.
Okay, but I understand she denies racial motivation in her affidavit. What reason does she give for the way those contingent assignments were set up?
I believe it was based on the volume in the areas, but I'd have to defer to the affidavit. I don't.
Okay, but we've also got the plaintiffs telling us they didn't exist, they weren't followed, and rather than having their bid areas expanded a little bit to cover the vacancies, they got moved to the less profitable areas, right? So why?
That is their position.
Yeah,
yes,
that's their testimony.
Yes.
Right. So. Why isn't that trial worthy?
I don't think it's sufficient to demonstrate pretext. So, the final issue to address is the claim of the hostile work environment and. The Casino Queen's position remains that the district court properly granted summary judgment in defendant's favor on those claims. And as the District Court properly noted there was simply no evidence of any severe, pervasive, discriminatory intimidation, ridicule, insult that would permeate this workplace. Those are obviously, it's a high standard to make those claims, and that just doesn't exist here, because the testimony of plaintiffs is that they actually like their job in all respects other than their supervisor. But there's no evidence that the supervisor engaged in any racial epithets, any humiliating behavior, threatening behavior, or anything of that nature. So there's simply no objective offensive conduct. Thank you.
Your time has expired, but I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I'll take less than a minute unless there are questions. I would just like to point out that the casino should be stopped from making the argument that the deposition testimony from Riley Jackson should not have been considered because it was referred to as a PACER document and not re-uploaded, because in their motion for summary judgment itself, they cited a document in exactly the same way. It's on page 138 of the record on appeal that they refer to an affidavit from the Riley Jackson trial, from the Riley Jackson case, in exactly the same format that the that Ms. Rogers and Ms. Alexander did in their response brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.